and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, the EPA's critical role in Alaska. Recorded Tuesday at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, listen to the Environmental Protection Agency's Alaska Regional Administrator, Dennis McLaren, next on Addressing Alaskans, after the news. You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. This week's program on the EPA's critical role in Alaska was recorded at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce on Tuesday.
Welcome to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce Special Tuesday Forum. My name is Chris Clifford, board member with the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, vice president and business relationship manager with Wells Fargo Bank. In August, the Environmental Protection Agency imposed cleaner fuel restrictions on large ships traveling within 200 miles of the coast of U.S. and Canada. These restrictions have generated concern from local cruise industry, as well as several lawmakers, who argue that they will raise costs for vacationers and Alaskans who depend on ocean-going vessels for basic goods. Today, Dennis McLaren, EPA's Alaska Regional Administrator, will discuss these regulations and how they could affect local businesses moving forward. I'm sure many of you will have questions, which is why we've provided the slips of paper on your table. After you write down your question, please hold them up in the air and Anchorage Chamber staff will pick them up. We'll get through as many questions as we have time for. Now let's get started with today's presentation. Dennis McLaren was appointed by President Obama in 2010 to serve as regional administrator for Region 10, leading a staff of 650 employees with responsibility for an annual budget of $500 million. Dennis oversees the implementation and enforcement of federal environmental rules and regulations in the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. This includes 271 tribal governments in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. Before moving to EPA, Dennis served as the executive director of the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, a state-chartered regional agency that adopts and enforces air quality standards that protect the health of 3.5 million Washington residents. Prior to that, Dennis served as the city attorney for the city of Port Townsend, the director of Seattle Department of Construction and Land Use. Dennis received his bachelor's degree from the University of Washington and a JD from Seattle University School of Law. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Dennis McLaren.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to the Chamber for inviting me up to Anchorage today. I always enjoy getting to Anchorage. I get here at least three or four times a year, and I've spent a lot of time traveling around Alaska the last few years as well. Always good to be here. And today I am going to talk about the North American Emission Control Area. I'm going to, in my remarks today, I'll try and give you an overview of how this set of rules, this international set of rules, has come into place, why it's important to public health, and what we're doing at EPA, especially in Region 10 EPA, to work with Alaska operators to ease the transition to the cleaner fuels that are required by these new rules. So again, what the impact of ship emissions is, what the emission control area is and where it came from, and how it will be implemented will be what I'm going to talk about today. Why do we care about ship emissions? you know, the main driver for reducing emissions from ships is that they were becoming a larger and larger part of our national emissions inventory for air pollutants. SOx, sulfur oxides, PM2.5, fine particles that are a driver of cardiopulmonary effects and asthma attacks that people have, and NOx, oxides of nitrogen, which also are an irritant to the lungs and can drive smog formation in many areas of the country. And as we looked out into the future, both in the U.S. and in Canada and across the world, it was pretty evident that if we didn't begin to reduce the emissions from shipping, that we would see an increased amount of pollution, an increased percentage of pollution in terms of our total emission inventory from each of these pollutants. So what this slide is intended to show is that pie of emissions from ships and other mobile sources, cars, trucks, locomotives, construction equipment, and shipping. And what we saw is that with no additional controls on shipping, we would go from a 2009 percentage of the SOx emission inventory from shipping of 80% up to 95% of the inventory. On PM2.5, those ultrafine particles that drive health problems for people, we would see the inventory go from 17% to 48% from shipping. And for NOx, from 10% to 40%. And those are differences between 2009 and 2030. With the emission control area in place, we would actually see the percentages go down for shipping, down to 51% for SOx, 12% of PM2.5, and 22% with NOx. And as I'll talk to you a little bit later, this is part of a sort of comprehensive look at all the sources of diesel emissions and the sources of SOx, NOx, and PM from mobile sources. Ships are one component of that, but as I'll talk a little bit later, we've been working on locomotives and construction equipment, inland marine, all of those sectors to bring them into line with what the technologies and the fuels allow. And what you know, what this slide is intended to show is that ships are a big percentage or a big chunk of the total emissions for some key pollutants in the U.S. And one of the reasons for that, international shipping runs on bunker fuels. Bunker fuels are what we call the bottom of the refining process. Some people call them black oil because they're very high in sulfur. They're very high in heavy metals. They're, in fact, so thick that you have to heat them to get them to flow. They're really the back end of the refining process, and as a result, when you burn them in engines, they're very, very dirty. And we've gone through a series of changes with respect to on-road engines and off-road engines and inland marine. Those fuels are now what we call distillate fuels or diesel fuels, and the diesel fuels are now in all of those categories down to what we would say is 15 parts per million sulfur. 15 parts per million sulfur is very, very low sulfur content, and it reduces the particulates and the SOx emissions from those diesel engines. And combined with that, we're also imposing new engine standards nationwide and across North America for those engines as they're built. And what that means is that when you look at bunker fuels, the world average sulfur content in bunker fuels is about 2.7%. That's 27,000 parts per million sulfur in bunker fuels, as opposed to 15 parts per million sulfur in our on-road fuels, our construction equipment, our inland marine now. So you can see that those bunker fuels are very, very, very dirty fuels, and they result in very significant emissions. And one of the problems with these ship emissions is that most of them are generated by ships that cross the ocean, that come into our areas from foreign ports. They're foreign flag vessels for most of them. And so We couldn't reach them by just doing an EPA rulemaking. It had to be done through an international set of rules done by the International Maritime Organization, which is a body that's composed of all the flag states where these big ocean-going vessels operate out of and they're flagged out of. And so this set of rules was actually crafted through the International Maritime Organization process. So what does it mean for Alaska? In Alaska, so I mentioned that we have other diesel engine regulations. You know, the rules for ships are just part of a broader suite of things that have been worked on over the last 10 or 12 years. You can see from this slide that the work to reduce diesel emissions spans really more than a decade. These rules have been phased in from back in 2006. During the Bush administration, the suite of diesel rules was begun, and really I think it started for on-road trucking in the Clinton administration, and then during the Bush administration we saw the rules for new fuels and new engine standards spread from on-road trucking to off-road equipment, then to construction equipment, then to inland marine, then to locomotives, and all of those went from relatively high sulfur distillate fuels down to 15 part per million sulfur diesel fuels. And new engine standards combined with those that showed that the technology along with the cleaner fuels would allow us to have very, very clean diesel engines across the board. And similarly for ships, the fuels and the technologies now will allow us to have much cleaner ships. So what are some of the annual benefits from this? About $290 billion in health benefits across the country by 2030 annually from reduced emergency room visits, reduced lost work days, reduced deaths from exposure to diesel exhaust. $290 billion in benefits quantified from this versus about $15 billion in costs associated with the new fuels and the new engine standards. So very big cost to benefit ratio here. Pretty hard to argue with $290 billion in health benefits versus $15 billion in costs associated with these rules for diesel. So let's switch to the next slide. What does this mean for Alaska? Well, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation estimated that the total sulfur oxide emissions from cruise ships hoteling in Juneau during one summer season would be greater than 350 tons of SOx emissions. And you can see in this slide that the high sulfur emissions from cruise ships are visible as a blue haze that hangs over southeast Alaska towns when the cruise ships come in the summertime in those ports. There is electrification. For some of the ships in Juneau, for instance, when they come in, they can plug in, and we've done the same in Seattle. But when they come in and out, and when they, for the ones that don't plug in, you do see pretty heavy emissions from the ships. And those emissions aren't just a visible haze. Those are breathed in by our kids and by our residents. And again, with diesel exhaust, the health research is very, very strong that the fine particles that are in diesel exhaust are so fine that they bypass the defenses in the lungs. They lodge very, very deeply in the lungs. They bypass the lung defenses, and they actually generate a variety of cardiopulmonary symptoms, everything from heart arrhythmia to heart attacks to increased asthma attacks for children. Lost work days for people, lost school days for kids, and again, as many as 30,000 deaths reduced across the country by 2030 with the implementation of these rules. So the top picture there is showing three cruise ships taken in Juneau. This was information submitted by the state of Alaska to EPA as we were considering these rules. That was in July of 2008. And then the inset shows a plume of visible cruise ship exhaust from about 3 nautical miles away, taken from an Alaska State ferry approaching Skagway back in 2008. And again, these are from photos submitted by the state of Alaska to EPA as we were considering whether to impose these rules in Alaska or not. And I think some other statistics that the state of Alaska submitted to us were that in from April 30th to September 27th, 2008, there were 645 individual cruise ship visits to Juneau, or nearly 4.3 visits a day on average in those months, the summer months. So let's switch to the next slide. As I said, there was a lot of analysis that went into whether to impose new rules for shipping, and these are what we call ship tracks. These are where international shipping and heavy engined marine vehicles pass around the coast of North America. And you can see in Alaska that you have some great circle routes that pass by, and then you have shipping that comes by southeast and up into the Anchorage area. And that kind of information was important in terms of where we set the boundaries for the emission control area as well. And in the U.S. and Canada, we see typically over 93,000 vessel calls in all the ports in the U.S. and Canada annually. And it's a big, big amount of our air pollution in the country that comes from shipping. This is just the international and coastal shipping. This isn't the intercoastal waterways or the inland waterways. This is just the larger ships that pass along our coast. So let's go on to the next slide. The International Maritime Organization, as I said, is a body that has been established internationally to look at what the regulation for shipping should be, and they have a whole suite of regulations, everything from safety to air emissions. And what we're dealing with here is Annex 6 to the International Maritime Organization. And this is where global sulfur standards are established for fuels and engine standards for ships. And under this process, back in about 2006, the President Bush and the Premier of Canada met and decided that it was time in the U.S. and in Canada to propose not only that the International Maritime Organization look at its engine rules and its fuel rules, but also that those two countries look at what happens close to our coast, within 200 nautical miles of our coast. So they committed to developing the North American Emission Control Area, and to working with the International Maritime Organization to set new standards for ships. And the Coast Guard is the U.S. representative to the International Maritime Organization, but there are representatives from shipping companies and industry, the Cruise Lines Association and others participate in this, the World Shipping Council, a lot of our entities that are engaged in shipping are part of that process. And the flag states that represent those shipping companies are who vote on what the rules will be internationally. And so what happened back in between 2008 and 2010 is that there was a process to try and push forward a set of new regulations for ships that would be consistent with what was being done in the other sectors of our mobile source inventory. And the U.S. and Canada made a proposal, the U.S. being the lead organization on this, for a global fuel sulfur standard. And there were a number of counterproposals by a number of folks, some that would have imposed distillate fuels worldwide earlier than this phase in, and some that would have stayed with the same rules. But ultimately what was put in place is that there would be a global fuel sulfur standard that would be phased in between now and 2020. In 2012, the global fuel sulfur standard would go down from 4.5% sulfur, 45,000 parts per million sulfur, down to 35,000 parts per million sulfur, or 3.5%, and then down to 0.5% sulfur in January 1, 2020. And there's a big shift when you get down below 1% in these fuels. It goes from bunker fuels to distillate fuels. So ultimately what this means is that by January 1, 2020, all of the ships on all the routes across the world will be shifting to a distillate fuel or a 0.5% sulfur fuel. But in the U.S. and Canada, because we saw the need for doing this a bit faster and a bit more aggressively because of the health impacts that were identified with this, we decided that we would propose that an emission control area process be allowed by the International Maritime Organization. And that emission control area phases down the fuels from the 4.5% down to 1.5% in July of 2010, 1% phased in summer of 2012 because of the timing of when we actually proposed it, and then finally a final tier in summer of 2015, which will take it down to 0.1% sulfur fuel. So what you see is a gradual phasing in of a lower and lower sulfur requirement on these fuels to get to distillate fuels. And along with that, there's some new standards for new build engines, meaning that as new ships are built, they'll take advantage of the technologies that are available as these lower sulfur fuels become the norm. So again, even at these levels, I'll point out that 0.1% sulfur fuel is 1,000 parts per million sulfur. That's much, much greater than what we have for inland marine and on-road fuels and locomotives and construction. Those are at 15 parts per million. This will take it down to 1,000 parts per million for the major ships. So the history on this, again, I think it really started in 2006 when President Bush and Prime Minister Harper met and laid the foundation by agreeing that the U.S. and Canada would jointly propose an ECA for North America. I should point out that there are emission control areas for the Baltic Sea, for the North Sea, and for the Caribbean, as well as the coasts of North America. And so those are coming into place as well. The U.S. ratified and became a party to Annex 6 of MARPOL in 2008, and the Congress ratified the treaty, and we followed the process for actually implementing rules under the International Maritime Organization process. And process included this ability to petition for ECAs when these rules were adopted internationally in 2010. So next slide. So part of that was then looking at what the boundaries should be within the U.S. And what this slide shows is what those proposed boundaries are for the emission control area. All of this area will be subject to the international fuel standards that by 2020 would phase down to 0.5%. But within this 200 nautical mile zone where you see the green lines there, that is where the phasing down started this last summer to 1%, goes down to 0.1% in 2015, is what we call the North American Emission Control Area. So it covers both coasts of the lower 48, covers the coasts of Canada up through the Maritimes, but not into the Arctic. And then in Alaska, it covers up to the west side of the entrance to Cook Inlet. So it covers southeast and the transit into Cook Inlet, but doesn't cover the Aleutians or the Arctic portions of Alaska, Western Alaska, or up in the Arctic. Now, you know, you might wonder, you know, what we went through in terms of getting to decisions about this, but we had input from the state of Alaska. We had input from a lot of different folks. We had a number of people saying, because of impacts of black carbon, we should extend the areas all the way up into the Arctic. We decided that there was really not enough shipping traffic or enough data to support going farther than the west end of Cook Inlet. And so these are the boundaries that we finally arrived at. And again, this is where the cleaner fuels will be phased in above international requirement of 0.5%. And I should also note that places like Dutch Harbor and Kodiak, where folks like Horizon ship goods out to, are not part of the emission control area. So ships that go outside of this area can continue until 2020 to burn bunker fuels. And in fact, for folks like Horizon, they're benefiting from an exemption for steamships that goes out to 2020. Horizon, mostly on their Hawaii operations, but some summertime operations up to Alaska run steamships, and steamships have some particular issues with implementing cleaner fuels, so they've been given an exemption out to 2020. And the benefits I've already talked a little bit about, but this puts it down into tons of emissions. You might imagine that when fuels are that heavy in sulfur, you do see some pretty big reductions in SOx emissions. 920,000 tons of SOx, 20,000 of those in Alaska alone, and similar reductions in NOx and PM2.5. And again, big monetized benefits in relation to costs and reduced impacts on emergency room visits and acute respiratory symptoms, cardiopulmonary symptoms, and that sort. And the health research on this is very, very sound. We think that in 2030, the combination of all of our national diesel rules, not only the ones for ships, but for all of the sectors of diesel, will prevent up to 31,000 annual deaths prematurely in the country, will reduce up to 1.4 million work days lost, and will really have some very, very big benefits for the country as a whole. We also realize, though, that if these rules were not phased in with some consideration to the impacts on places like Alaska, that there would be some difficulties. So the rules at the International Maritime Organization do have some flexibility. They have a couple of provisions in them. One is to recognize demonstration projects for new technologies, and the other is to allow equivalency. And so if you have something like shore power, or you have a technology, one of the technologies that I worked on very early in this process, because we anticipated this coming, was working with Holland America on a seawater scrubber. You know, coal plants and other facilities on land have had scrubbers on their emissions for a long, long time. And there is a technology that's been used in Europe to use seawater to scrub the emissions out and still allow a ship operator to burn bunker fuels at their lower cost and be able to scrub out those emissions with a seawater scrubber. It's a very promising technology, and we worked with Holland America to put a pilot in. It was one of the early generations and not as advanced as the equipment that's available now that's in use on a number of ships in Europe. But that is one opportunity where you've got equivalency provisions to come up with a technology that's an alternate to burning the cleaner fuels. And similarly, there is a provision that allows you to do technology demonstration projects, and that's where we're working with Tote Motion Trailer Express, and John Parrott's here in the audience from Tote. John had the foresight to approach us a couple of years ago at EPA Region 10 and say, not only do we want to do shore power, which they have in place in Tacoma, and EPA helped by providing some grant funding to assist with that, but they wanted to look at an option of going beyond what the emission control area requirements were for cleaner fuels by looking at liquefied natural gas as a fuel. And so Tote has approached us and has gotten approval for a demonstration project that allows them over the next several years to convert their ships to liquefied natural gas, run 2% sulfur fuels in the interim, and keep their costs down, and ultimately put in place a technology that will be up to 5 times cleaner than what the emission control area requirements are, and also potentially have significantly lower costs than they have now for their fuels. And John, I don't know if you want to say a word or two about what you guys are doing, but it's a really groundbreaking technology demonstration. It's one that has the potential to be the next fuel and the next technology for ships around the world. Not every engine configuration can be converted to it, but for new builds, I think there's a tremendous amount of interest in it because natural gas has decoupled from petroleum. You know, one of my jobs as the regional administrator for EPA is when we have, you know, these kinds of requirements coming in is to try and work with the businesses and the entities within our region to make these things work. And John and his company, with great foresight, came to me a couple of years ago and said, we have this thought, we have this proposal. Can you help us work with your headquarters people? Can we put this together in a way that will make sense, because we can't do it, you know, by 2012 or even by 2015 completely. We need to work together and you know, using the rules that the IMO has put together and the flexibility that we have, we can do these sort of things. And we've done similar things with some of the cruise lines. We've got an agreement with Royal Caribbean Lines that's been signed and put in place to do some technology, to do average banking and trading, and now we're working with technology issues with them. I'm committed to working with the other cruise lines on this to see how we can make things work for them as this gets phased in. And Horizon, you know, has been in discussions with us as well. Alaska Tanker Lines, ships very, very similar to what Tote has, but carrying crude oil from Alaska down to California and the refineries in Western Washington, is very interested in doing the same sort of approach and proposal as John has put forward with Tote. So we're very active right now in trying to work with companies to see this phase in a way that makes sense and can be done cost effectively. And again, that's part of my job as the regional administrator to take these international and national rules and then apply them here in ways that we can make sense with the sources that are in our region. So again, we've got ongoing discussions with a number of other folks. Tote was sort of the groundbreaking first one. Royal Caribbean Lines was the first groundbreaking one for cruise operators. And we know we've got some tough negotiations still to come with others on this, but I'm very confident that we will put this in place and make it work and do it in a way that works for Alaskans and won't drive up the cost of goods in Alaska, and we'll keep the cruise lines coming to Alaska as is so important to the tourism trade up here. So reducing ship emissions is an important part of what we're doing at EPA to bring better public health and cleaner air across the country. It's just as important in those Southwest Alaska towns as it is anywhere in the country to have cleaner air and to have those reduced impacts on kids with asthma. And so it's an important part of our overall strategy to reduce exposure to diesel exhaust, and ships are a big proportion of that. There's international support on this. I've been involved in this now for probably 6 or 8 years before I came to EPA. I worked with the ports and with the World Shipping Council and the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association and a number of others on how could we put in place rules that actually made sense. And a big issue for the ports and for the shipping companies was consistency. What they were facing was individual towns and states putting rules in place, like California, that would have required a different fuel than would be required for Alaska or would be required for Washington State or would be required in the Gulf Coast. And that patchwork of regulations was very worrisome to the industry. So they wanted us to come together with the IMO to an international set of regulations that would have consistency, that would be something that everybody could work with and know what the requirements were going to be, would be phased in over time, and would give everybody a fair shake at complying and have an even playing field on this as well. So what we're doing is trying to work with businesses to find flexible solutions, but we are very focused on getting to the end result here, which is improved air and improved public health for folks. And hopefully today I've given you a little bit of a taste of how we got here, what we're putting together, and how it works. And I know there's some questions that people have, so I'm happy to answer questions.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with the EPA's Alaska Regional Administrator, Dennis McLaren. He was recorded speaking on the EPA's critical role in Alaska at an Anchorage Chamber of Commerce forum on Tuesday, November 13th. You can find a link to Mr. McLaren's slideshow presentation on our website at alaskapublic.org. Following his talk, Mr. McLaren responded to questions submitted by audience members.
We had numerous questions, actually. And first of all, how did the Great Lakes region get exempted from the ECA rule? How does the EPA plan on imposing the ECA rule on the Great Lakes, possibly in the future?
Yeah, well, in the Great Lakes, what you have is an iron ore fleet, old steamships, many of the ships 90 or 100 years old. So that steamship exemption that I mentioned for that applies to some of the Horizon ships also applies in the Great Lakes area. So very different kinds of shipping and kinds of ships there, and so that that steamship exemption applies there. And long term, you know, when the world sulfur requirements come into place, the 0.5% sulfur fuel, people will have to replace those old steamships and you know, put more modern vessels into place. But it gives some time. It gives some space for that to be phased in.
Okay. Thank you. Does the EPA conduct economic forecast studies before the rules are passed? If yes, how are these studies executed?
Well, you know, our headquarters folks, our Office of Transportation and Air Quality, is required to do you know, that type of analysis for every one of the rules that we do. And I talked a little bit today about the cost-benefit analysis that was done. And so what we try and do is look at what the costs of imposing a new rule might be in terms of, in this case, it's primarily increased cost of fuel. There's no doubt that bunker fuels are inexpensive because they are the very bottom of the refining process. You know, what we do know is that there's differences in different areas of the country in terms of what that differential cost for fuels is. And so we did a world fuel analysis in this instance with Canada and went out and looked at the world fuel markets, looked at what the cost differentials were expected to be, and then compared that to what the health benefits would be. And before the U.S. government went to the International Maritime Organization, there was a pretty good, solid analysis in hand. And then when EPA imposed the emission control areas, that analysis was done for the emission control areas as well. So pretty significant cost-benefit analysis were done, and I talked about some of those numbers in the presentation.
Thank you. I think this one really kind of deals with the landmass of Alaska, and you've touched on it. Why include Alaska when Alaska is not shown to have air quality problems? I think one of your slides showed the plume of smoke, but
one of the issues here is people confuse compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards with impacts from diesel exhaust. National Ambient Air Quality Standards are whether you're in attainment or out of attainment. We have, you know, one area in Alaska, Fairbanks, that is out of attainment of the PM2.5 standard. Doesn't have anything to do with ships up there. It's wood heat and you know, the inversions that happen in Fairbanks. But separate and apart from the ambient air quality standards, which are the issue of attainment and non-attainment, are impacts from air toxics. And diesel exhaust is one of those compounds that, when breathed in, causes these health reactions. As I said, cardiopulmonary symptoms. It doesn't cause asthma as far as we know, but what it does do is for people with asthma, if you're exposed to significant amounts of diesel exhaust, it'll generate an asthma attack. And that's particularly concerning to us with kids because juvenile asthma rates have gone up very significantly. And so we don't want kids to die from asthma or, you know, miss school days from asthma or have those symptoms exacerbated by exposure to diesel exhaust. So there's a difference between attainment of the ambient air quality standards and the impacts of diesel exhaust. And this is a rule that's intended to really focus in on both the ambient air quality standards in some cities like Los Angeles, but it's also intended to reduce the impacts of diesel exhaust on lots of folks that live along the coastlines.
Thanks. Well, as far as part of that study, as far as talking about hospitalization or people with illness, has there been shown hospitalization in Alaska due to the cruise ship emissions or perhaps in the city areas, the towns?
You know, I don't think there's been any Alaska-specific study, but there are a number of studies around the country that have been done that show that when particulate concentrations go up, hospital visits go up. And there's one in Seattle that I'm very familiar with, but there's been, you know, many of them, and PM2.5 in Alaska and diesel exhaust in Alaska is the same as it is anywhere else. And if you're exposed to significant amounts, it can have a health effect.
Then back about on the lines of economic impacts, studies of cost to rural Alaska. Rural Alaska has been hit particularly hard with economics and small business, because Anchorage Chamber, a large portion of our membership is small business. What sort of economic impact on those particular areas?
Yeah, again, part of the consideration in not extending the rules out to the Aleutians and around to western Alaska and the Arctic was, those kinds of considerations. And so, interestingly, though, a lot of the goods get out there by tug and barge as well. And tug and barge has, for a number of years now, been running distillate fuels. In fact, they always ran distillate fuels. Now they run 15 parts per million distillate fuels. And so those are rules that were imposed earlier. This really applies to the large ships like Toad or Horizon. And again, the Horizon vessels that operate out to places like Kodiak and Dutch Harbor are outside of the ECA when they go out into those areas. But we know there are impacts, we know there are cost impacts, and that's why we're working on some of these flexibility provisions and why we're working with folks like Toad on alternatives.
Thank you. And then a final question about enforcement. The new EPA rules, can you provide an example of the following? Who would enforce a tugboat violation scenario or perhaps a cruise ship violation scenario?
Yeah, the Coast Guard is charged with enforcement, and the Coast Guard has held a series of workshops on that. What they're looking for is logs that people might have that show that they actually purchased lower sulfur fuel. Tugs and barges are a different, they're not subject to the ECA. They're subject to our other rules that have been in place for some time. But for the large ships, the Coast Guard enforces, and again, they'll do periodic inspections and look at fuel use logs and purchase logs and that sort of thing.
Thank you. Once again, help me thank today's main speaker, Dennis McLaren.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with the EPA's Alaska Regional Administrator, Dennis McLaren. He responded to questions submitted by audience members following his talk on the EPA's critical role in Alaska, recorded at an Anchorage Chamber of Commerce forum on November 13th. You can find a link to Dennis McLaren's slideshow presentation at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.